Thank you, Chairman. Today's presentation is based on our seminar series in the Hillary term, Southeast European Realities Among Europe's Multiple Crises, and on CSOC's annual seminar in the Megaron in Athens last month. My task is to sketch out what's happening in the triangle of uncertainty surrounding Southeast Europe, before handing over to the experts who will tell us about what is happening inside the region. Frank will brief us about migration flows in reception and transit countries. Othon will tell us how Russia in particular is viewed in the region. And Addis will look at the geopolitics of ideas and the challenges to liberal democracy. Lord Lothian has given some of the background. I shall add only a few points before offering a snapshot of the Middle East and of Russia based on our Megaron seminar. Traditionally, Southeast Europe has had its own long-running internal crises in Cyprus, in former Yugoslavia, or between Greece and Turkey. But the region is now an importer of crises from outside, and especially from the surrounding region, forming the triangle of uncertainty. To the east, there is Russia, with a more assertive and unpredictable policy. To the south and east, North Africa and the Middle East, the neighbourhood is marred by violent conflict, in particular the cataclysmic civil war in Syria, foreign intervention, extremism, inter-Muslim cultural wars, and failed hopes, and with the resulting flood of refugees. There are also problems to the north and west. The soft power of the EU is hampered by economic and political weaknesses and structural imbalances. Relations between Southeast Europe and wider Europe are complicated by the role of the region as border area and entry point. From both inside the region and from outside, there are the perverse influences of populism and demagoguery, and the post-truth era is pervasive in public and political discourse. The Middle East has destabilised Europe since the Arab Spring of 2011. The pressures of migration affect most directly the countries least able to cope. Fear has bred hostility to migrants and to strangers. Now the Middle East region is in turmoil, adding to the pressures on the West. The gaps opened by the Arab Spring have been filled not by civil societies, but by militias with guns. The region has never been more violent or fearful. There are cold wars, Iran-Saudi Arabia, Israel-Palestine, hot wars, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and legacy wars, Afghanistan, Iraq. The destruction in Syria is catastrophic, with levels of destruction not seen since the Second World War. Russia has clear interests and strategy because of Syria's unique position as a Russian client, which has brought the latter into direct involvement in the fighting. Syria and the war in the Ukraine have effectively brought to an end the post-Cold War settlement, with its vision of an open and united Europe from Lisbon to Vladivostok. But Russia never bought into that vision. It seems to believe in a system of great powers with zones of influence and opposes a unipolar world. It particularly resented the eastward expansion of NATO. Russian policy appears essentially non-ideological and reactive to specific contingencies. Russia's main focus, inevitably, is still the United States. But Russia still sees relations with Europe as important, especially in terms of trade, energy, and culture. And these relations will continue to reflect elements of conflict, competition, and collaboration. Russian actions in Ukraine have brought about a strengthening of NATO in the Baltics and Poland, and also encouraged EU countries to think more about European defence, though they need to remember to factor NATO and the United States into their calculations. One final overarching point from me. Turkey has a role to play in four key issues affecting Western Europe: migration, Middle Eastern terrorism, security, including Syria, uncertainties about Russian intentions. The West needs a consistent approach to Turkey. This needs discussion and, above all, clarity in various fora. And this is precisely where academia and think tanks can help. And I hope, Chairman, that we might be able to set up another joint venture in the new year. Frank, over to you, and then to Othon and Addis.
Go. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I will be talking about the migration refugee crisis of 2015-2016. I should say this is based on an ESRC-funded research project which we conducted last year. We surveyed 500 migrants and refugees and 100 stakeholders in Turkey, Greece, Italy and Malta. So just to set the context, we tend to talk about a series of crises. Crisis of displacement in Syria, Iraq and elsewhere. We can relate that very clearly to the different outbreaks of violence, backlash of the Assad regime, then the ISIS advances, and later on the intervention of Russia. We have a crisis of border controls that also related to a humanitarian crisis in Greece and on the Balkans, a crisis of refugee policy, and the crisis of the European Union. Quickly, overview, you've probably seen all that. We mustn't forget there are over 22 million people displaced in the neighbourhood of the European Union, and that includes 2.5 million people or so in Ukraine, but only 5%, 1 million, of all of these moved to the EU. So the majority is actually displaced and still in the region. We cannot simply talk about one flow of migrants and refugees. Instead, there are many. We had these over 1 million people arriving from outside Europe. They were joined by another 250 people from inside Europe, from Macedonia, Albania, Kosovo, Serbia. And this year, another 300,000 people had arrived. We distinguish between two flows. 85% came through Turkey, so the Eastern Mediterranean route. 15% came through Libya, that's the Central Mediterranean route. We can distinguish these into many flows, subflows and sub-subflows, like from the Middle East, Southwest Africa, East Africa, and so on. From our interviews, we learned that there are 94 different routes used by the migrants and refugees. They crossed a total of 57 countries, and they stopped at over 3,000 different locations. So that's a fairly complex picture. We also distinguish now between three types of movements. The first group traveled fairly fast, days, couple of weeks, up to 6 months, from their country of origin to the EU. That's about half of all those arrived last year. The second group stayed in another country along the road, like Lebanon, Gulf countries, Libya and Turkey, to make up their mind, find out and decide what to do next. They stayed for half a year to 1.5 years. This is about a quarter of our total sample. And the third group, first, resided as immigrants in other countries, mainly Iran, Sudan, Libya, on average 3.5 years, but we found many who stayed somewhere else for 10, 15, 20 years. That's almost a third of the total. Many did not actually initially intend coming to Europe. They responded to the conditions in these countries. We also distinguish between different waves. We saw a second wave mainly of relatives of those who arrived first, and that was from autumn-winter last year. So the magnitude of the flow that we saw last year is the merger of several subflows, all with separate root causes and dynamics, and the result of different cohorts or waves. These have different characteristics. In the Eastern Mediterranean, 88% present themselves as refugees. It's over 70% had secondary education, so it's mostly educated urban middle classes. 45% were women and children. Now it is almost 60%. In the Central Mediterranean, only 62% presented political motivations. levels of education were significantly lower. I haven't got the exact numbers yet. And only 25% were women and children, because in this case, mostly families were actually left behind. The mode of migration, visa policy, introduction of visa by Egypt, by Morocco, by Tunisia, and closed borders, basically channeled people towards Turkey and Libya. There were no other loopholes left. Visa to the EU were largely unavailable. 10% in our sample applied to some kind of visa, family reunification, student visa, but they were rejected. Many more considered, but knew there is no chance, so they didn't even apply. And this then created this famous demand and the market for irregular travel. Smugglers were omnipresent all along the route. Basically, in all these 3,000 locations, there were also smugglers. They could be found easily. They advertised their services with prices and telephone numbers on Facebook. They approached people arriving at Izmir Airport and coach stations. We found two types of drivers in the country of origin, mostly political, but also economic, often a mix, but also the driver in the first country of residence, like Turkey, South Sudan, Libya, and Yemen, is important. Lack of status, lack of income, discrimination, racism, outbreak of violence. So we distinguish between the primary root causes and the secondary root causes, and this is important because we need to address these drivers separately. Now to the political dimension. Large-scale displacement obviously already began in 2011, but the EU and international community were rather complacent, I would say. The issue was left to be dealt with by the countries in the region, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey. Calls for a Syria refugee conference in 2014 were ignored, and the recent UN refugee conference in New York a couple of weeks ago came, I would say, too late. In detail, that means Turkey was lacking solidarity and burden sharing by other countries. There was also a lack of reception capacity, only 250 places in camps for over 3 million people. There are diversity security challenges, the southern borders, the Kurdish areas, terrorism, and emigration. But this led to a policy dilemma. And the western border situation was the least severe threat to Turkey. Turkey was also often criticized for refugee and human rights violations and avoided last year to overtly harsh restrictions. And this created a mix of drivers and opportunities for people to move on from Turkey to other countries. Libya, no government to speak of, I would say, but militia and gangs exploit migration and rather create a push factor. Greece, earlier last year, abandoned compulsory detention, ended unlawful pushbacks, and thus diminished the deterrent factors. There was also an inadequate reception regime that was partly deliberate, I would say, because there is a belief that creates a pull factor, so they didn't want that. This resulted in a humanitarian crisis on the arrival points, the islands, and all along the route. And due to Greek pressure, Macedonia finally opened the border and let people go. Italy, very different situation, introduced the rescue operation Mare Nostrum in the central Mediterranean, much more and better organized the reception regime. So little or no humanitarian crisis. Germany at some point recognized migration wouldn't just end, that Greece and the Balkan countries were overwhelmed, whilst reports of humanitarian crisis were compellingly presented by the media. Germany then suspended Dublin II regulations, which basically allowed people to move on to Germany. This was to some extent done, I believe, to relieve Turkey, Greece, and the Balkan countries, to address the humanitarian crisis and end the suffering. The response was informed by the discourse on population aging and shrinking. It was supported by the business community, by the media, by civil society. And finally, quickly look at the EU. I distinguish two phases here. Until May 2015, the EU kept rather quiet. With regards to Turkey, it felt a bit like a laissez-faire approach. I was in Ankara in summer last year several times. In August, I talked to EU ambassadors, different EU staff. They were sort of shrugging shoulders. They only responded or began responding to the maritime disasters in the central Mediterranean in May and June last year. Then we had the Valletta summit, agenda on migration, action plan on smuggling. But until September 2015, the focus was on the central Mediterranean. Little action was taken in the Aegean. Successively, the EU came up with a rather comprehensive policy mix of humane and repressive measures. Talks were about addressing the root causes, improving conditions in Turkey, regular resettlement and relocation to sort of prevent the smuggling, tighten border controls, so more Frontex operations, NATO vessels, enhanced reception and asylum system. We had the hotspots, return where appropriate. But most of these politics were not implemented due to the reluctance of the member states. And only in October last year, the EU-Turkey action plan was revived. And only in March 2015, the EU-Turkey deal came into force. And that was the game changer. It didn't change or address the issue of displacement in the region, but the issue of irregular migration on to the EU. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lord, for chairing this panel, and I would like to say thank you to Jacqueline for organizing this for us. It's a great pleasure to have our fourth joint event. And as David has already mentioned, this is about us studying the impact of geography on the region of Southeast Europe. And that involves, obviously, the social dimension that Frank has just described, and then the internal dimension that Addis will be describing. And what I would like to focus more is on the role of Russia. Now, I have to say from the beginning that I'm not a Russian expert. I'm a Southeast European studies expert. In that sense, my kind of approach is how the Russian bear is viewed, has been viewed historically indeed, because the role of Russia in Southeast Europe has been a role of a neighborhood, but not a direct neighborhood that Russia has always been really, really interested in, but a very important, nevertheless, area in its relationship with Europe. And we all know that historically there was a competition between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and that affected, obviously, the independence of all these Balkan states that were often helped actively by Russia. And also, even during the Cold War as well, when the relationship was quite varied, and although Greece was the only country that was not part of the communist bloc, even within the communist bloc, the relationship between the Soviet Union and the countries in the Balkans was different, with Yugoslavia having a more independent kind of course, Bulgaria being the more orthodox ally of Russia, Romania having its own competitive environment with the Soviet Union, and Albania from starting as a Russian ally, close one, and then distancing itself and being much more totalitarian and closed. So there's been this kind of variety. And after 1989, it was Russia mostly in the context of the multinational environment and the liberal international institutionalism in the context of the Yugoslav wars. We could say that the active engagement and the active presence and the different voice that came from Russia came after the Kosovo independence. So 2008 was a year that was quite crucial in terms of Russia not recognizing the independence of Kosovo, and then how the relationship was affected between Russia and Southeast Europe by the global financial meltdown, then the Eurozone crisis, until you know, today that we are seeing much more bigger challenges and many more challenges actually than before. So I would like to, in this relationship between Russia and Southeast Europe, I would like to kind of look at three basically kind of approaches, which with us having the main question in mind, whether Russia is a counter-narrative to Europe for the countries of Southeast Europe. So one approach describes Russia's influence in the region in terms of geopolitics. It's the engaged relationship. It's the relationship that sees the Southeast Europe as the soft underbelly of Europe, and how Russia tries to divide, infiltrate, and disrupt the European environment by using Southeast Europe. The second, other side approach is the more disengaged, in that it views Russia as not particularly interested in the region, but being much more interested in its own kind of neighborhood, the post-Soviet space, as well as China, the United States, or the important European powers like, you know, Germany or France or the UK. And obviously the competition with the Middle East. I was in Moscow 2 weeks ago, and I have to tell you that the climate is quite intense. The language is very much that of a nuclear kind of language. And competition, especially with the United States, and now at the time with the U.S. pre-election, I mean, Russia is upping the game. And then the third one, the third approach, which I will describe, and I think I'm much closer to this one, is that Russia keeps Southeast Europe at the slow burner, keeps relations at a low cost, that is a much more opportunistic relationship, which is also reciprocated from the other side. So let me go through these three approaches. The first one that looks at the geopolitics and the geopolitics of fear, it has to do with mostly insecurity, and that the Southeast Europe is the weakest link in Europe, the soft underbelly of Europe. The rise of nationalism, illiberalism and Euroscepticism is something which is very convenient and is inviting Russian influence and engagement, and indeed also cooperation, but also financing, as we read, of various actors within the region. The freezing of the enlargement agenda is also something that helps Russia take advantage of those countries being in a limbo in a way, because they don't know when the Western Balkans, their accession prospect is going to take place. There is also a degree of military cooperation with Serbia. There's been some also joint military actions together. There's a common anti-Western strategy, which we are seeing now with Turkey happening, and also Russia infiltrating political parties. The role of energy is very important, in that the region is dependent on energy resources coming from Russia. From Russia. And then also the particular approach of Russia regarding conflicts such as Kosovo and blocking UN recognition. So that is actually the one approach which we do see a lot, and it talks about a really intense engagement in the region of Southeast Europe, and especially at this particular conjunction. Now, it has to be said that states are divided in this kind of relationship, because some of them are much more in favor of having a close relationship with Russia, and that includes Greece, which is a softer country in terms of sanctions. It includes Serbia, the Serb Republic of Bosnia, Republika Srpska, Montenegro, and Bulgaria, and now what we're seeing happening in Turkey. And there are also countries that oppose, there we have a much more pro-American influence in Albania, in Kosovo, the Bosnia community of Bosnia and Romania. I think it's especially important to look at what's happening now between Turkey and Russia, and how that relationship goes between, you know, from cold to warm, and then from warm to cold, and again to warm. Now, the second approach is the disengaged kind of approach, and that is more like the EU for the countries in the region is the only game in town. So the influence of Russia is not particularly, you know, anything significant for us to worry about. Looking at gas dependency, for instance, yes, but at the same time, that doesn't have real political leverage. Look at Montenegro, for instance, right now, and Zhukanovic, who was, again, re-elected this week. He really has an anti-NATO stance, an anti-Russia and a pro-NATO stance. So even in a country like Montenegro, which has a lot of investment coming from Russia and gas dependency, that really doesn't translate into, you know, a pro-Russian attitude, but much more into a pro-EU. And obviously the energy field is particularly important because by wanting to bypass Ukraine, Russia tried to build a number of supply of countries which would provide for the supply route for its energy, going from Belgrade to Sofia and Banja Luka and Skopje and even Zagreb, what we used to know as the South Stream pipeline. But the South Stream was something that was abandoned as a project at the initiative of Russia, and also because there were many EU problems that were associated with this, and EU disagreements regarding the building of the South Stream. So that creating even further disappointment in the countries in the region vis-à-vis Russia, which shows that kind of disengagement and that disengaged approach. Then, indeed, there is investment and trade and financial assistance, but that's not particularly significant anyway, according to this view. And even the pro-Russian parties, because there are pro-Russian parties that exist in the region, like the Serbian People's Party, or the Alliance of Independent Social Democrats of Dodik and Republika Srpska, or the Alternative for Bulgarian Renaissance, Montenegro's New Serbian Democracy. These are clearly pro-Russian parties, but they are not that significant. They are quite marginal in this political spectrum, and that's what really matters in the party politics of this country. And lastly, even from a Greek perspective, that the country always consistently has a warm relationship, let's call it like this, with Russia. When it tried last year during the serious period of crisis and the change of government to Syriza to attract investment and even present Russia as an alternative to the, you know, to the Eurozone and negotiate with the creditors having a harder stance, that didn't succeed at all. Russia didn't want to use this kind of opportunity. So what leads me, and that's kind of my final argument, is that the relationship is much more tactical and much more opportunistic from both sides. Russia doesn't have a long-term strategy or a long-term vision vis-à-vis Southeast Europe. Indeed, I think it is challenged whether Russia has a long-term strategy, the way that China, for instance, has, or that Europe is trying to, you know, to build. But yet there is a soft power that exists, a Russian soft power in the region, which relates to the past history of Russian involvement and help during the Ottoman Empire and the disintegration, the Pan-Slavism, the language which is spoken in Bulgaria, the big diaspora community. That's something particularly important, for instance, in Greece, in the north of Greece, where there are many Pontic population that have come to Greece, and they are a big pro-Russian element. There is also the Orthodox tradition, the brotherly ties with some countries. Of course, that shouldn't be overstretched, but it just shows that there is a kind of significance in terms of the Russian. And also what Russia is trying to do is present this sense of victimhood, victimhood from the West. And that, to my mind, is also a sign of weakness, you know, coming from a very big power, a global power, to use this sense of victimhood in order to connect with the other countries. With Turkey also, we realize that it's a very opportunistic relationship, so much so that we are actually questioning whether the very recent decision to revive the South Stream is something which is going to be sustainable. I mean, we all at CISOX believe, and we've got a lot of Turkish experts there, that the NATO identity of Turkey is something which is much more long-standing and is much more strategic for Turkey. So how much the Russian engagement is going to challenge this, or even that competition with the Nabucco pipeline, is something that we need to take into account. But having said that, we clearly see that there is a closeness between Erdogan and Putin at the moment in their anti-Western kind of discourse that they very much use at the moment. So what we're seeing from the countries in the region, and I'll close with this, is that most of them, they're using Russia in whatever way they can, when they've got difficult kind of negotiations or difficult times with Europe, in order to be able to say that there is some kind of an alternative. In reality, the EU is the only game in town, but still that game is going to be played, I think, in the future.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and thank you, everybody, for coming. Our topic today is geopolitics, and I would like to approach it from a slightly different angle. The concept of geopolitics assumes that states are the main actors in international relations and that they have clear-cut interests when they engage with one another. Understanding these interests helps us explain actual state behavior and lets us arrive at conclusions for probable future actions. However, in addition to this geopolitics of interest, I would argue that there is also something we may call the geopolitics of ideas. And it is quite fitting that we hold this event today in the National Liberal Club, for the ideas currently being challenged globally seem to be precisely the ideas of liberalism and democracy, or liberal democracy in other words. Many of you may remember the 1989 article by Francis Fukuyama where he proclaimed the end of history. Many people misunderstood what he was actually saying. He was not saying that we have entered a new world devoid of conflict and confrontation. Rather, he was claiming that with the fall of communism, the world had been devoid of any structurally coherent ideological alternative to the values of democracy, the rule of law, and liberalism. It is in that Hegelian dialectical sense that the debate was over and history had ended. And if we look at the development since the 1990s, there is some evidence for this thesis. The number of democracies in the world has increased, and the world's economies are interconnected and interdependent to such a degree that classical wars between states have become rather isolated phenomena. We furthermore find that the number of classic and executive coup d'etats has declined, and the same goes for election day voter fraud, meaning when you simply change the results of the elections on election day. However, the number of what our Oxford colleague Nancy Bermeo calls promissory coups, and these are coups that frame the ouster of an elected government as a defense of democratic legality, and make a public promise to hold elections and to restore democracy as soon as possible. This number has actually increased since the 1990s. Similarly, we see a rise in what she calls executive aggrandizement, meaning that through a series of small constitutional and structural changes in the political and legal systems in the countries, the executives increasingly undermine systems of checks and balances in order to aggrandize political power. Bermeo also finds that we see a rise in manipulating elections strategically, meaning through hampering media access, using government funds for incumbent campaigns, keeping opposition candidates off the ballot, hampering voter registration, changing electoral rules and members of electoral commissions, or simply harassing opponents. On a different level, we see all those things that David has talked about. We see a declining trust of democracy, especially among younger generations. And we see lower identification with democratic institutions. We also see a rise in xenophobia, a rise in populism, and anti-democratic parties, and a rise in extreme political demands, be they from the right or from the left. Now, if you talk to the academic community, they will usually put up three explanations for these global trends. The first one is that we are confronted with a global crisis of neoliberalism. Confronted with growing inequality and the consequences of casino capitalism, nobody can deny that the dominant economic model is in crisis. Many believe the current economic system to be beneficial for the selected few, while the majority actually loses out. The financial crisis of 2008 gave this train of thought much prevalence, but the larger trends behind it were established long before that. There is a repeatedly established correlation between people feeling that they lose out in the economic and political systems and those people voting for extremist or protest parties. So this explanation argues that declining trust in the economic model leads to a crisis of democracy and to protests and protest votes. The second explanation deals with the inadequacy of democratic institutions themselves. Some have suggested that we have entered a post-democratic era in which the mere notion of democracy and the institutions on which democracy relies, namely elected representative parliaments, elected governments, and elections, are not adequate anymore. Contemporary societies are much better educated and interconnected than they were, say, 200 years ago. So we need a new institutional setup in order to accommodate this fact. The third strain of thought is that we are dealing indeed with a crisis of liberal democracy. Some suggest that what we see globally is simply evidence for the inadequacy of that model. Democracy, and we have to admit that, tends to produce sometimes chaotic results, and it tends to bring in people to power which we don't necessarily like from a normative point of view. At the same time, liberal ideas like citizen rights often appear negotiable, especially in times of growing security concerns. It does seem that there is no dialectical triumph of liberal democracy as a model of governance economics, even if there is, as of now, no coherent alternative to it. These three general explanatory patterns have been put forward on a global level, and none of them is actually capable of explaining the phenomena in its entirety. However, they all provide interesting insights. And if we now come to Southeast Europe, we can see a steady rise in neoliberalism in this region as well, and at times even authoritarianism. So the question emerges, how much of this rise is actually connected to these global trends that I've just outlined, and how much of it is actually the result of internal developments to the region? And if we look at what is going on in the region, we find that actually we have a slightly different pattern in the region than in the globally. In the past 25 years, the Western Balkan states have been involved in a profound transition process that was supposed not only to reform their political and social systems, but also their economic systems. The European Union was a big proponent of this policy and early on presented the Western Balkan states with a clear membership perspective, provided that they fulfilled the Copenhagen criteria. This accession perspective is still very powerful in the region, and we do not find truly Eurosceptic parties in the Western Balkans governments. And also very, very few of them in the party systems. All the governing parties in Southeast Europe are, in a sense, reformist parties. According to their party programs, all of them want to complete this transition and bring their countries to full-fledged membership in the European Union and, to a slightly lesser degree, NATO. Also, these governments do not openly challenge the notion of liberal democracy, unlike some governments in the European Union do. And the Euro-Atlantic or European integration has been a teleological fixture in all Southeast European states, even if the commitment of the governments to do the needed reforms has had its ups and downs. However, it is important to acknowledge that the actual membership in the European Union is far, far away, and for many states in the Western Balkans, and even the fruits of a gradual convergence are not as potent as one might think. The economist Dusan Relic has actually calculated that even if the Southeast European states do all the necessary reforms right now or as soon as possible, even if there is an absolute commitment to these reforms, the point of convergence between the economies of Southeastern Europe and the European Union would only be reached by the year 2040 or 45. So this is the reason why, from a purely economic point of view, the only logical choice for younger people in these countries is to emigrate and to seek their luck elsewhere, and the phenomenon of brain drain has been omnipresent in the region. The problem is, of course, that the EU cannot push actual or prospective candidates to reform if they do not want to. There is no way of pushing unwilling reformists other than the fact that the membership perspective becomes even more elusive. But the fact this elusiveness has actually created a vacuum, and the political elites in the region have filled it, and also some other actors, as we heard from Arthur. And there is also one aspect that has been neglected so far, and that is the increasing reliance on the European Union leaders, on the domestic leaders, because these have created the perception that stability in the Western Balkans can only happen if you cooperate with them. A further difference to the global trends is that the governing parties in Southeast Europe are not truly populist. While it is true that they employ populism when it serves their interest, and particularly before elections, when they are actually in government, they act rather pragmatically and have no problems in changing previously held positions. In fact, this is a general feature of Southeast European governments. Ideological differences do not matter very much in terms of daily politics. What you have instead is the phenomenon of a great leader who rules the parties in almost an absolutist manner. The modus operandi of the Southeast European political elites has been the method of state capture. Contrary to the ideal type model once advocated by Max Weber, in most Southeast European states there are no independent bureaucracies that would ensure implementation of governmental decisions or secure some form of bureaucratic consistency and durability and predictability. Instead, state structures and resources are often at the mercy of the ruling parties, which makes the bureaucracy highly dependent on the ruling coalitions. This is the deeper reason why some reforms, even when they are adopted, are actually not implemented if they contradict the wishes of the parties. At the same time, the judicial systems are either ignored or made to comply with the demands of the ruling elites. The simple fact is that the ruling parties in the region have become something akin to employment agencies that use state resources to distribute perks to their followers. It is easy to see how these structural preconditions have led to a general crisis in legitimacy and democracy in the region. Irregularities during election processes have become regular phenomena. At the same time, public protests against governments and demands for more transparency, good governance, and the rule of law have increased. Let me conclude. What we see in Southeast Europe is not the result of a global crisis of liberal democracy, a global crisis of democratic institutions, or a crisis of neoliberalism. None of these three explanatory patterns actually holds up to scrutiny. And strictly speaking, it is also not the result of the current crisis within the European Union. Most of the regimes in Southeast Europe came to power long before the current crisis ever started. Rather, it is the result of a combination of the EU's incapability to insist on and actually encourage reforms on the one hand, and weak or rather not fully formed state institutions incapable of resisting political pressures on the other hand. The current crises have aggravated these trends, but they did not cause them. We are not confronted with a generalized rise in illiberalism, which would kind of assume that you had liberalism before, or a democratic backsliding, but simply with a slowing down of the democratization and liberalization processes. If the European Union wishes these processes not to stop completely, it needs to reinvigorate its commitment to the region, make EU accession a credible option again, monitor the implementation of adopted reforms, and stay true to its values. It also needs to broaden the process by not simply relying on elites, but also on populations. This will not only create pressures from below, but it is a fact that only if the citizens see the benefits of EU integration is there a possibility for the entire EU project in the region to be sustainable. Thank you very much.
Thank you.